This is Lama Tantrapa. Welcome to the Secrets of Qigong Masters, the talk show brought to you by Academy of Qidao, the first and only school in the world offering professional education in Tai Chi and Qigong coaching. To find out about our programs offered by Academy of Qidao and to find out how you too can become a certified Tai Chi or Qigong coach, please go to qigongcoaching.com. This show is also brought to you by Mastery Magazine, sponsoring the Summit of Qigong Masters and bringing to you some of the top experts in Qigong in North America. Today, I am delighted to introduce to you Joe Pinella of Tucson, Arizona. Joe is a Tai Chi and Qigong teacher, introducing people mostly in retirement communities around the Southern Arizona area to the arts of Qigong and Tai Chi, as well as working with some professional athletes. He was in a car accident 25 years ago when he literally got his neck and back broken and got diagnosed with being quadriplegic for the rest of his life. He managed to recover his health with the practices of internal arts and now helps hundreds of other people do the same. Thank you, Joe, so much for joining us today for our show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank
you. Great. Would you share with us a little bit about your introduction to the internal arts and what happened as a result of that?
Well, I had the fortune to be introduced to Qigong as a youngster about 14 years old in New York City, in the Buddhist temple in New York City. At the time, I had no idea what I was learning. I was just exercising and learning something that I thought was really interesting. Little did I know that at a certain point in my life, it would change my life, save my life, and then become a way of my life.
What inspired you to get involved in the study of Qigong at such a young age?
What inspired me at that time was no one knew about Tai Chi yet. I learned in the 60s. No one knew about Tai Chi or Qigong until David Carradine had the movie Kung Fu. So in the 60s, it was absolutely unheard of in this country. And what was going on at that time were a lot of the military people were coming back from the East, and they were bringing arts back with them, different arts back with them. Right. And so everybody I knew was practicing karate at that time. That was the rage during the 60s was karate. So sure. The military people came back and they learned karate while they were out of the country. And when I went to the Buddhist temple and I saw this soft, easy art, and it just fascinated me to watch how they move. And then when I saw the power that they had, it was just an unbelievable.
What kind of power did they have?
Well, they had the power. They had the power to move people, to push people, to help people, to fix people who were injured and stuff. So because it was a temple, they really didn't teach martial arts. But they strongly believed in self-defense. Mm-hmm. You know, they always believed that self-defense, you know, was a part of the survival mechanism. So I saw power that was, you couldn't see it, but all of a sudden it was there. So that's what attracted me to it. You know, as everybody who was practicing karate, you could see it. You could see the violence in it. But in the soft arts, you didn't see any violence. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing to me. As a 14-year-old, just mesmerized by it and decided to take it up as a practice.
How long did you practice back then for?
Well, I practiced so many times. I practiced until I went off to college from that point in that temple. But once I went off to college, then I started looking for different teachers. And I've actually had probably 20, 25 teachers over the course of time. So I was always looking for more knowledge, more knowledge, more knowledge. And what I found was by having different teachers, I was exposed to a lot of different ways to see the same thing, but from different perspectives.
Right.
And again, I really didn't know what I had. I didn't know what I had learned and how valuable it would be at a certain point in my life. But in 1991, when I broke my neck and my back in the car accident, and after five operations and physical therapy, I wasn't getting any place. As a matter of fact, I was losing ground because physical therapy was trying to teach me how to be disabled. They were saying, you have to learn how to be disabled. You have to learn to be disabled. Mm. I was like, wow, that doesn't really sound like fun, you know, to learn to be disabled. So I called back to the temple in the city and through interpreters, talked to the monks and told them what had happened to me. And they said, oh, perfect, use Qigong. And I said,
were they the same monks that you had studied before with?
Some of them were, some of them were. There was a revolving set of monks. Mm-hmm. What there was is, in New York State, there are about, we visited about six different temples in New York State. Mm-hmm. In New York City, the temple is a storefront. Right. But upstate New York, they actually have temples, you know, real temples. Mm-hmm. And so the fellow who had introduced me to the practice, he was on a mission here in this country to visit all the temples. Mm-hmm. And so then I started to go with him to all the temples. And every
in the wheelchair?
Well, no, I was already, this was when I was a teenager.
Oh, okay.
So I had gone to all these different temples and I had all these different monks. And these monks would just kind of rotate around through all the different temples. So in 1991, when I called back to the temple, I don't know who the monks were there, which ones were there, which ones weren't, but we had more than one conversation. There were a number of conversations.
Right.
And so what they told me was, look, you have to use your mind. Even if you can't move right now, use your mind and imagine you're doing the exercises. So they told me what to do. They said to me, what you want to do at this point is get into a hot tub or whirlpool or pool, something where you can shut your eyes and imagine that you're back in the womb again, back in your mother's womb.
Yes.
When you were born and you were in the womb, everything that you became started from the sperm and the egg. So Everything is there already inside of you. So shut your eyes, make sure you keep your eyes shut so that your body doesn't know what's really going on. And when they put you in a chair and lower you into the water, imagine that you're doing the exercises and your body will figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for 7 months, I spent 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon in a hot tub, up to my neck on a chair.
Yes.
And I would, the hot tub would bubble and my arms would bubble and move and stuff like that. Well, it took about 6 or 7 months before I could actually say, I wanted my arm here, I wanted my arm here, I wanted my arm in different places. Mm. And at that point in time, you know, I called back to the temple again and said, I'm starting to be able to move. Mm. You know, I was, like, for instance, there was one particular exercise they told me that I should embrace, and that was called Earth, the movement of Earth from the five elements. And they said, that's a very balancing pose, very good for your energy, very good. And it's probably one of the easiest things you can do is to start moving. It's just to wave your hands.
Yeah, it's cool to do this earth element exercise underwater.
Yeah. So that's what I started to do. And then what they told me to do is, after I told them that that was starting to work, they said, okay, now you have to switch to Tai Chi. Now you have to switch to Tai Chi because Tai Chi is going to teach you how to do everything on the right, everything on the left. So there's a style of Tai Chi called Sun, that uses a lot of joint rotations. Mm-hmm. And they said, start doing the joint rotations, because if the energy is stuck in your body, it's going to be stuck most likely in a joint. Mm-hmm. Straightaways are going to be clear. The joints are where the energy is going to get stuck.
Okay.
So with some research and some books and what I had learned there, I found a whole list of Tai Chi circles, and I started to do those circles. Mm-hmm. And at first they were, you know, just little tiny things and stuff. Mm-hmm. But over time, I started to be able to get control of myself. Well, then there was a problem because I couldn't eat, I couldn't shave, I couldn't take care of myself. I could move now, but I still couldn't do everything I needed to do. And they said, okay, so now what you do is figure out what it takes to get your hand to the plate and to your mouth. Mm-hmm. And then turn that into an exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if someone knows how to eat,
that's my favorite exercise.
But we don't really realize how much goes into getting the food from the plate. Mm-hmm. So when I first started out, every time I'd pick up my arm, the food would fall. Pick up my arm. So then I realized that, well, first thing is hit the food, then pick the food up, and then bring the arm up, and then bring the arm in, and then get it here. Mm-hmm. Then empty it. So that's a whole series of moves. So what I did was I created exercises. I actually made exercises up, and I practiced. Pick up the food, put it down. Pick up the food, put it down. Pick up the food. And I did
and
that
did it with both
hands.
Nice.
I learned how to eat with both hands. I learned how to shave. I learned how to do everything with both hands. Nice. Because in Tai Chi, you do everything on the right and on the left.
So they say.
And, yeah. And that's how this whole thing started. Now, I can make it sound really simple, but it didn't happen simple. It was 7 years.
Well, it sounds simple. It may not be easy, but it's simple, all right.
Yeah. And that's how it started. It started, you know, after I started to get my motion back and started, then I had to create an exercise. I had to physically make up an exercise for everything I wanted to relearn how to do.
Right.
And again, 7 years later, this is the result of all of that work.
Well, no, it's not 7, it's like 20
now
years
it's 25.
Later. 25 years later.
Yeah, this June 5th would be 25 years ago that I had my accident.
Right, so after that 7 year period of time, you have been not only feeling more capable within your own body, but also helping other people, right?
Absolutely.
So how did that happen? How did you develop a practice like this?
All right. At this time now, after the 7 year period, I was reevaluating my life, and I'm saying, you know, my doctor said that I was the only person in the world that he knew of who had lost 2 vertebrae, 4 discs, and was a paraplegic or a quadriplegic, mm-hmm. and now was moving again. He said, mm-hmm. never heard of that before. He said, there are some cases where quadriplegics and paraplegics get something back, but they never move smooth again. They always move jumpy and jumpy. Mm. Oh, I started to think and think and think and say, well, why was I saved? You know, why am I this person, the only person in the world, possibly, that has accomplished this? Mm. And it came to me that, well, maybe I was saved so I can share what happened to me with other people. Because the hardest part of my recovery was the hope part of it. I've left out a lot of the story, and a lot of the story is there was a lot of depression. There was a lot of times when I thought about killing myself and suicide and all that stuff. And
but then you figured out how to hold the razor in your hand, so you were just going to shave yourself to death.
So I thought about it. You know, my doctor was really, he was a great doctor, but he was so adamant that it's not going to work. At one point, they sent me to a psychiatrist. They had me on all kinds of drugs. They said I was in denial. They said I was...
They thought you were delusional.
They said I was... I refused to accept the reality that this was going to be my life, paralyzed.
And you probably were prescribed some drugs.
I was on Elavil, amitriptyline, Robaxin, Xanax. They had me on this whole thing.
Whole soup.
Yeah, this whole soup. So then I thought about it and thought about it, and I said, well, what I have to do now is I have to give people hope. Mm. Because when the doctor tells you there is no hope, most people
give up hope.
Give up. They just give up. And that's the end of their life. Mm. So I decided that I should start to teach people what worked to heal me. And if I could show people that I was broken beyond repair, and now I'm not, then every time someone hears from their doctor that this is never going to happen, or that's never going to happen, or they're never going to get better. There's always hope. There is hope. The doctors give you their best opinion, but that's an opinion. And so that was how I started this practice that I have now, where I go to the retirement communities.
Did you go to retirement communities from the get-go?
No, I started in a couple of the ranches here. They have mm-hmm. a lot of ranches where people come and visit and stuff, mm-hmm. like resort ranches mm-hmm. and stuff. So I started in that setting first. And then I wound up in a couple of doctor's offices until mm-hmm. I met my wife, Debbie. Debbie was in one of the doctor's offices where I started to practice that. Mm-hmm. And over time, I realized that the people who needed me the most the people who were 60, 70, 80, these are the people who, they retire, and they spend their whole retirement going to doctors, going, you know, for medicine, going all this. So I decided that maybe it would be better if I focused my attention on the group of people who needed this most. And these are the people who get all the kind of diagnoses every day. You know, oh, this is never going to happen, and that's never going to get better. Mm-hmm. Well, I see about 2,000 people a year.
That's pretty good.
And I've been doing it here in Tucson. This is my sixth year here in this particular place, which this is the first retirement community where I started.
So you moved to Tucson straight from New York City, or did you live elsewhere?
No, I was in Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
So that's where I lived when I had my accident.
I see.
I lived in Scottsdale, Arizona.
I see.
A little north of Phoenix. And that's where I, you know, my accident was reflexed. So I moved down here. I had a friend of mine here, and he said, why don't you come down here? This is a really nice place. You know, Phoenix was getting busier and busier, crazier and crazier. Mm-hmm. So Tucson is still a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more low-key. So I came down here, and eventually I was practicing in the park one day, and a man came up to me and asked, is that Tai Chi? And I told him yes. And he said, would you like a job? We're looking for a Tai Chi teacher here at the Highlands. And I said, yeah. And that's how I came here. I came up here and I started.
So what, was he in position to offer a job?
No, he was just one of the residents here.
Oh.
He was one of the residents here. He said, but they had been looking for a Tai Chi teacher.
Huh.
And so I came up here and we struck this beautiful deal, and I have that gorgeous room where you were this morning.
What's the beautiful deal?
The beautiful deal is that, you know, I had this opportunity to be with all these people who needed this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the city, it was different. You know, people came there for exercise.
Right.
People don't come to my class basically for exercise. They come in because they leave, they feel better.
Right.
So it's more about their health than about just an exercise.
Wellness.
Yeah, more about wellness. And you know, I started up here, and before you know it, we were talking about food, and before you know it, we were talking about exercise, before you know it, we were talking about the whole wellness part of the body. It's so much more. You know, Qigong, they say, exercise is king and nutrition is queen. Well, most of these people didn't have any kind of concept about food.
You know,
these are the people who grew up, if you're 50 and 60 and 70 years old, in that time of your life growing up, everything was organic. You didn't have to eat organic. We didn't have processed foods back then. We didn't have plastic containers back then. We didn't have plastic water bottles. So basically, they had a good foundation. But somewhere along the line, things went haywire on them. And so now, I was able to introduce them back to it. You know what? You have to start paying attention to what you eat, because no matter what we do here, your eating is the nutrition. It's the fuel. So you give your car bad fuel, it stops. You give your body bad fuel, it still goes, but it doesn't work as well. So you do the exercises, you eat better, and pretty soon you're going to start to feel better.
No doubt. And the beautiful thing about it is that it's a lifestyle. So it's not just some kind of exercise routine that you attend once or twice a week. It's actually something that you engage in on a daily basis. I mean, eating food.
Yeah. And most of the people that do my classes wind up doing 3-4 days a week of exercise, even if they don't do it with me. We made the first DVD so that people could take it with them, because a lot of the people live here are snowbirds.
Right.
And they would say, boy, we miss your class while you're not here. So I said, okay, we'll make a DVD so you can take it with you.
Right.
And so we made a DVD, and the DVD has been phenomenal. And it's the exact class that we do on a Saturday morning here.
Uh-huh.
And the healing DVD, and those were the exact exercises that I used to heal. So I assumed, and it really worked out well, I assumed, well, if those exercises worked for me, then they should work for anybody.
That's a big assumption to make.
Well, if you come from the point where all those exercises do is bring the body into balance, and they bring every system into balance. So, you know, I like to explain things with cars to people, because people understand that. You can have a car, and if the motor doesn't work, the car doesn't run. But you can have a car that the radio doesn't work and the car still runs. Mm-hmm. And the air conditioner doesn't work and the car still runs. No? So there's certain things that can happen in the body, but the body still works. Mm-hmm. So your digestion could be out of balance, your blood chemistry can be out of balance, your oxygen, all these things can be out of balance and you can still function. Now if something goes wrong with your heart, it's a different story. So the process of doing this kind of exercise eventually brings every system into balance. If you have high blood pressure, it goes down. If you have low blood pressure, it goes up. If you have diabetes, your processing of the sugar starts to get better. In other words, your body starts to function much more efficiently. So that was my assumption, that if I could make their bodies function more efficiently, then over time, everything would start to work better.
I agree. It would also stand to reason to say that different people have different issues that they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they probably would need different focus on particular aspects of the practice. Because, well, that's what they need to address first. Perhaps if they cannot walk, it's one type of exercise. And if they cannot process blood sugar, that's a different kind of exercise. Eventually, it would be great to cover all bases, so to speak, but perhaps there are different strokes for different folks, wouldn't you say?
To some degree. You know, when we get into specialty problems, you know, individual problems, then we can alter a program for a specific problem. But initially, we start with get the body in balance. And balance means every system in the body has to come into balance. When every system in the body is working to its full potential, then the little problems, they go away all by themselves. They just go away.
Interesting. So how do you assess, or what kind of feedback do you look at to make sure that you can say that all the systems of the body, or the particular system that is in question, is actually working at the functional or optimal level?
Well, how I assess that is because my clientele are always coming back to me with feedback from their doctors.
So you send them to the doctors?
They see their doctors. I don't get involved in anybody's medical situations. Mm-hmm. But these people, because of their age and because of what's going on in their lives, they do see doctors. So someone goes for their checkup, and they come back to me and go, my doctor was in absolute shock. My blood oxygen level is up to 92. You know, it used to be 68. And somebody comes back to me and says, they've cut my insulin medication 3 times already, and now I'm not on a mule anymore, I'm on a pill. So that's how I know things are working, because every day, every single day, I get feedback from somebody. They come to me and say, my eyesight is getting better. How could that be? I don't know, but keep doing the exercises, you know? When people tell me they have an eye problem, I say, okay, there's eye exercise, and I make them do some eye exercise. I give them homework to do. Mm-hmm. So my classes are general maintenance for the whole body. But if you have a problem, you come talk to me, and I'll tell you something else to do.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So essentially, you have two approaches. One is general maintenance that you offer to the general public, say group class, and the second is focused attention addressing particular issues.
Absolutely.
And helping the person heal those specific issues, and then perhaps they can also enroll in the class and do more maintenance.
Now, I do a lot of private practice work with people. I do post-surgery, pre-surgery. Now I tell my people, look, if something is happening and you need to go into the hospital and have surgery, how are you going to get in shape after the surgery? You have to go into the hospital in shape. So I do rehab before they go into the hospital.
Prehab.
Before they have a knee replacement or a hip replacement or a shoulder replacement. Because these are the common problems. Mm-hmm. And they're the same in all the active adult community. You know, the problems, you can just write them down, they're the same problems. Mm-hmm. You know, knee's a big deal. You're 70 years old, knee replacement, big deal. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're having problems walking around, you can't get up and down how are you going to get up and down? How are you going to recover from surgery when they assault your body?
Right.
Okay? So I tell people, get in shape before the operation. And it makes it a breeze to come out with.
And sometimes you don't even need the operation because you got in shape and perhaps figured out, oh, most of my knee problems are because of misalignment of my lower limbs.
Exactly. I can't tell you how many times that's happened. It's been a number of times where people were going to get something done, and 3 months later, they don't need it anymore.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Great. How do you find clients for your private practice?
Word of mouth. Everything is word of mouth. If I help someone, they're going to tell their friends. They're going to tell their friends. And these communities are very close-knit. Mm-hmm. Now you'll find there are a lot of people in here who know each other. And in every community I work in, it's the same thing. Because these people have come from wherever they've been, they've come here for retirement life. Mm-hmm. They don't come with their friends or their family, so now they have a whole new circle of friends.
Right.
And the circle of friends is how it goes. If this person had a problem and now they don't, they tell their neighbor, and their neighbor tells their neighbor.
Or perhaps neighbor notices, oh, what have you been doing? I used to see you on the walker, and now you're just sprinting around.
Absolutely.
I want that too.
Yeah. And that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
When you try and introduce someone to something they don't know anything about, it's always better if they have their friends telling them about it, mm-hmm. rather than me telling them. Me, I can tell them whatever I want. Mm-hmm. But when they have their friends go, what? My doctor is telling me that my health has changed, that I'm much better off. When I went for my yearly physical, I can tell you 100 stories, but I'm going to tell you a funny story. We had a fella, he was from the Vietnam War, had been really affected by Agent Orange, and had some serious health issues, breathing issues, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So every year he goes up to the Mayo Clinic for his yearly physical. Well, this past year when he went for his physical up at the Mayo Clinic, in the middle of his physical, he was working on the treadmill, and they had his heart monitored, and they had his oxygen monitored, and they had all this stuff, and they had him on the treadmill. About halfway through his setup, they came in and told him that they had to change machines. So, what does he know? He goes on to the next machine, they hook them all up again, and they start over again. And they're doing the thing over again. And they finished the test, they went in to see the doctor to get the results, and he said to the doctor, what was wrong with the first one? He said, well, what was wrong with it is that we had your statistics from last year, and we had your statistics from this year, and we assumed that the machine was broke because there was such an improvement. Never seen that much improvement in 1 year.
Did the other machine that they put them on?
They put them on a second machine. They showed the same thing. So that's the kind of feedback that keeps me alive, that keeps me going. That at least I know that I am helping somebody every day.
Oh, that's wonderful. So you essentially are an epitome of a wounded healer who experienced a major trauma, managed to recover, and then go back into the community to share the gifts that you discovered through the process of self-recovery.
And that was the realization I came to when I decided to do this, mm-hmm. is that maybe that's why I was saved. Maybe that was my purpose in life. It was to stop me from where I was going and redirect my energy.
Right. How did you support yourself during those 7 years that you were recovering?
Well, at the time of my accident, I was already retired.
Really? How old were you then?
I was 42.
How did you get retired at 42?
Well, I owned several businesses in New York City. I was semi-retired, because as soon as I moved to Arizona, I started buying businesses again in Arizona. So I was a businessman my whole life. Mm-hmm. And that was a big realization, that as much money as I had when I had my accident didn't help.
Right.
I mean, it gave me good care, it gave me, couldn't buy my health.
What kind of businesses were you in?
I owned an auto body shop, I owned a used car lot, I owned a construction company, I owned a gift shop, I owned 3 insurance agents. I had 12 businesses in New York.
Oh boy. You kept yourself busy.
Yeah. And that was the point when I said, well, you know, making money was not, didn't change my life, it didn't help my life. Mm-hmm. And this has helped my life, so this is what I got to do now. And so,
well, having business acumen, was it helpful in establishing yourself as a professional in this new field?
Absolutely. Because most of the people who do this kind of work really don't have much business experience, and they don't run it as a business. They just, you know, do it as maybe a sideline or a hobby or just a personal pleasure. But if you're going to do it as a business, then you have to have all the nuts and bolts in order. I mean, taxes, insurance, room rents. I pay room
rents. If you have employees, perhaps payroll as well.
I don't have payroll yet. I have a free worker.
Your wife, my wife.
She does all the paperwork.
Nice.
So, yeah, I run it like a business. Mm-hmm. I don't run it like it's, you know, it's a hobby. It's not a hobby. It's my business now.
Well, this is one of the fewer examples, I would say, of Qigong and Tai Chi professionals actually operating successfully as businesses,
yeah,
or as business owners. Because, like you said, most people who learn Tai Chi or Qigong or related disciplines don't have much in the way of business savvy. And so they don't really know how to get started and where to go from there, how to get nice contracts signed with organizations or communities, and also how to promote what they have to offer. So in other words, promotion is something that perhaps the majority of Tai Chi and Qigong players have very little idea about, because there's almost like some kind of stigma. Oh no, he's a self-promoter. Well, if you don't promote yourself, who is going to?
Exactly. And that's a key, you know. I had to make myself different than everybody else, and that's why we don't promote it as Qigong or Tai Chi. We promote it as healing movements.
And what's the difference?
It is Tai Chi and Qigong. But when you try and push Tai Chi and Qigong, people come to those classes for exercise. Yeah. I wanted people to come to my class for healing, so we decided that healing movements, the movements that I use to heal, would be better as a Western way of introducing the Eastern to the Western. Mm. People in the West, especially in this kind of a community, in an active adult community, maybe never heard of Tai Chi, maybe never heard of Qigong.
Well, unless they watched the Kung Fu series in the 70s.
So, how do you get them to come to class? Well, you call it healing movements. Then they come to class and find out they're doing Qigong, they find out they're doing Ba Kwa, they find out they're doing Tai Chi, they find out they're doing meditation. Most of the people are in shock when I tell them, what you're doing now is paying attention to everything you do, which means that you're meditating.
You're mindful. That's the definition of mindfulness.
Absolutely. So the exercises stimulate alpha in your brain. Mm-hmm. That means that you're in meditation. So if you tell somebody, come to a meditation class, they won't come. You tell them to come to a healing movement class and you let them meditate, you don't even have to tell them. It happens automatically to them.
It's kind of a backdoor approach to meditation.
Without having them go, what is that? Now they go, oh, can we do that? Yes.
Right, well, and I experienced your class today, and at the end of the class, there was a lovely meditation where we switched from doing cloud hands to moving hands through the cloud and then gathering this cloud substance, the energy, into a ball, like a snowball, and then rolling it around, making it more condensed, smaller, and eventually bringing it into the body or the clasp of the hands. So that's definitely a form of energetic meditation.
Absolutely. And even the second breathing exercise that you did this morning, where I called the colors out, the visualization. You're getting all the chakras. When you bring the cup, I don't talk to the people about chakras. This is not the community to talk about.
Oh, you did mention that though.
I don't think I said chakras.
Yes, you did.
I did. But I just tell them, look, imagine the green, imagine the yellow, imagine the colors going through your body. Well, every color's got a vibration. If you think of the color, the vibration is in your body, and every organ in your body corresponds to one of those vibrations. So just the fact that I say to draw green through your body, draw red through your body.
Well, let me ask you about this particular exercise. You suggested visualizing these colors simultaneously with the reversed breathing. Mm-hmm. Why reverse breathing? Why not natural breathing?
Okay, because reverse breathing strengthens the diaphragm.
How so?
Excuse me?
How so?
Well, the diaphragm is a muscle that normally hangs down.
And so normally it sticks up, actually. It sticks up like a dome.
Yeah, here under the ribs. So when you take a reverse breath, you suck it up into the lungs. The lungs will massage the heart. So you massage the lungs, you massage the heart.
So the diaphragm actually has to relax in order to be able to suck the tummy in, because the internal organs cannot get squeezed. They can only go somewhere. So they can go up the diaphragm. So that requires the relaxation of the diaphragm.
Yeah. So once you get the diaphragm to go up into the lungs, it pushes on the lungs. What do the lungs push on?
Expel the
heart.
Air. Well, it also expels
the air.
But that's supposed to be in time with inhalation. You said that when you suck the tummy in, you inhale. So then you somehow have to counteract the action of the lungs expelling the air. If the lungs are trying to expel the air, but you're forcing the air in, how do you do that?
Okay. In North Star Qigong, they use reverse breathing, that particular style of reverse breathing for every exercise. When you take a reverse breath and suck in your belly, and you're taking air in, what are you going to do to your lungs? You're going to expand your lungs.
In which direction? You cannot expand them downwards.
No, they're going to expand them this way.
Up and out. So basically it's what we call the thoracic breathing, or higher lobes of the lungs get the chance to actually breathe. The lower lobes don't get the chance to breathe.
Right.
Okay, so that's basically identical to what people refer to as the shallow or stress-related breathing. And so I was curious about the reason why you would facilitate that in your clients or
in that particular
attendees of the class.
Well, that was what I learned. That's why I teach it. You know, I learned it that way. I learned that when you pull the belly in, it causes the vertebrae in the back to roll instead of hinge down. So pull the belly in and roll down, your whole spine rolls. In the meantime, you've got air inside your lungs, so your lungs are expanded to their full capacity. The diaphragm is pushing up on everything, pulling everything up. The lungs are now being massaged. The lungs have five lobes, three lobes on the right side, two lobes on the left side. The bottom lobes of the lungs are where all the problems start for people.
And you cannot ventilate those when you're doing the reverse breathing, because your diaphragm is squeezing those lobes.
That's what you want them to do. You want them to massage those lobes. Mm-hmm. Those are the lobes where all the debris gets stuck, where all the junk gets stuck. And that's where a lot of the problems start in the lungs. Mm-hmm. So now we get that part of the lungs. I have people come to me who say, you know, I smoked 30, 40 years ago, and I started doing the reverse breathing, and I'm spitting up stuff coming out of my lungs.
And they wouldn't be doing that if they did a natural breath.
It hasn't happened so far in their life. You know, so we give them something new to do and something changes.
Well, maybe they were not breathing naturally either. Maybe they were just breathing shallow because they were smokers and their lungs were shut down.
That could be, but I've never had anybody come to me and say that everything changed before they did reverse breathing. It's been after reverse breathing that they've done. Because I've had a lot of people come to me and say, oh, I've done breathing exercises, oh, I've done Tai Chi before, I've done this before. Mm-hmm. But until you start to do that reverse breathing, those bottom lobes of the lungs could be sitting full of stuff.
Unless you actually do full abdominal breath, which will ventilate those lobes.
Yeah.
They don't get ventilated when you squeeze them with the diaphragm as you're sucking the tummy in while trying to inhale at the same time. There's no chance for those lobes to actually get ventilated because they're being squashed between the rest of the chest cavity and the diaphragm.
Yeah, but as long as you're taking air in, they're going to still be pushing out against the diaphragm. The diaphragm is pushing up, so they are going to fill.
Right. Well, you can't really take much air in because there's going to be much less volume in your chest cavity because the diaphragm intrudes into your chest cavity, leaving much less volume available to take air in. So you'll only be ventilating a fraction of the volume of your the full capacity of your lungs. Unless you're breathing through the respirator, you know, like if you're scuba diving, and it just kind of pushes the air into your lungs.
Well, again, this is what I was taught, and this is what I've been teaching, mm-hmm. and these are the kind of results that I get. Mm-hmm. I can't even think of all the different stories, you know, that I can tell you about people who have breathing problems. COPD is a breathing problem that supposedly has no cure, because you lose lung function, COPD. So I have a fellow that comes to me and said, you know, for my birthday, I want to take my 34 grandchildren, I want to walk up the volcano in Costa Rica, but I can't breathe. What can I do?
Good luck.
So we start, I make them do that breathing exercise, which that breathing exercise is part of something. Have you ever heard of an exercise called mingling fire and water?
Sure.
It's a breathing exercise. Mm-hmm. Well, breathing, mingling fire and water, the way I learned it, was a deep breath, belly out, right. A reverse breath, belly in, chest out, back and forth. Mm-hmm. So I had the man lay down on his bed every day and do that exercise laying down, because laying down it was much easier to do it than standing up. Mm-hmm. He had 9% VO2 intake when I met him. And after...
9%? Yeah, he was still alive.
He was in such bad shape that he could not walk to his mailbox.
Oh, I see.
Okay? Wow. He was in really, really rough shape. So I, through some private lessons, had him lay down on the couch and start that breathing practice. 8 months later, he took his 34 children and went to Costa Rica and climbed the volcano. And led them up and led them down. His breathing was up to about 20-24% at that time. Mm. Well, the doctor said, there is no cure for COPD. He said, I don't understand what's going on. Well, we wouldn't fix the COPD, but what we did was we let what was left of his lungs work more efficiently. And his oxygen uptake was almost 2.5 times more than it had been before. But it was enough that he could do that trip that he...
So I would imagine that in his particular case, I'm not familiar with him, but I just can hallucinate about it a little bit. So I can imagine that his lower lobes were really in bad shape, were not functioning properly to provide any kind of ventilation, any kind of oxygenation. So he literally just forced his upper lobes to compensate.
Absolutely.
To basically provide that kind of breathing capacity that the lower lobes couldn't do anymore, and so apparently that worked for him well enough to be able to hike up and down mountain.
See, the one thing I've learned is that I never try and figure out why.
Really?
Yeah, why? It works. You know, do I have to know which lung is working better, how it's working here or there? If I can get somebody to do something they couldn't do before and they're happy about it, then I know that it worked for them, I'll try it with someone else. If it doesn't, I'll try something else with them. But, you know, the science behind it is not that important, is if it works.
Well, you said that you went to 20 plus different teachers, and they all had different slant on internal arts, and that allowed you to see how there were certain correlations or certain underlying principles that were common among them.
Yeah, and there are. There are certain principles that are common to all of them, but they all have their little take different.
Right. So if you don't mind sharing with us some of those core principles, what would those be?
Okay. The core principles that I believe in is that breathing is the beginning of everything. You know, so the breathing is what sets the body in balance, okay? When you can start to breathe like the ocean, like I talked about this morning, you breathe like the tide goes in, the tide goes out. Mm-hmm. But once you balance the energy, everything starts to work better. And we use the word balance, but I use the word balance for everything. I don't use it for just standing balance or sitting balance. Every system in your body has to come into balance.
Absolutely.
So balance starts with breathing. Mm-hmm. You don't fix the body without the breathing. You fix the breathing, and then you fix the body.
It has to be balanced between intake and exhalation. Yes. Otherwise, you'll be either bloating up or you're going to be deflating.
One of the other principles that I talk about in my classes is the expansion and contraction in the body. Mm-hmm. You know, there are no bones touching bones unless you're injured or unless you have arthritis to a certain point. Mm-hmm. But there's an expansion and contraction that happens in the body. And most people are so rigid that nothing happens. When you see an animal breathe, the whole body breathes. The whole animal breathes, okay?
I was just talking to my girlfriend this morning about how you can tell whether or not the person has tension by observing the toes of the person lying prone or supine, doesn't matter, and whether or not there is movement of the toes in rhythm with breath. Exactly. If there isn't, there is some
tension,
some severe obstruction.
Absolutely. And one of the other principles from Qigong is that the body is one piece. It's not pieces. I don't ever think about fixing one piece of the body. I always believe that you have to fix the whole body. And so I tell my students, look, think of your body, or think of this fascia in your body. Mm-hmm. This fascia in your body is really, really critical. And in Chinese books and everything, they always refer to the silk, really the silk. Mm-hmm. Well, the silk they're talking about is the fascia. If you think of the body as has this complete set of fascia in it, and the toes are connected to the head, and the arms are connected to the legs, everything is one piece. So how do I get them to envision this? I tell them, think of a bed sheet. I'll get four people to hold the four corners of a bed sheet, then I'm going to drop a bowling ball in the middle of the bed sheet, and all four people are going to be drawn in. It's the same inside the body. The center of the body, where the dantian is where the energy came into your body and is born. That's the center, okay? Mm. That's the center of the body. The fascia from the center to the toes, from the center to the hands, to the center to the head. Mm. So you have a bad shoulder, it affects your hip. Your hip affects your neck affects your... So compensation patterns, balance problems, start with the fascia. Mm. Fix the fascia, everything gets easier, everything gets better.
How do you fix the fascia?
Fix the fascia by doing exercises that balance the fascia, strengthen it on one side. We talked about that earlier today, about the weak side of the body, the non-dominant side of the body dictates how strong the dominant side of the body can get. Mm-hmm. So that's a fascia problem.
Right.
So you fix the fascia by doing Tai Chi exercises, the circles, those are the ones, the healing movement DVD that I gave you this morning, those are the exercises that are going to start to balance the fascia. When you do something on the side that's already strong, it doesn't get stronger. When you do something on the side that's weak, it will get stronger. So eventually, both sides will come into balance. When both sides come into balance, and then to really tune up the fascia, then you have to go to a different level. Just the healing is not enough that's going to start to train the fascia. To train the fascia takes between 6 months and 2 years. To restructure it. So, again, the people who want just healing, they do this level. The people who want a little more, do this level. The people who want to really get extreme sports, they do this level, because at extreme sports, then that fascia has to be 100%.
Right. Has to be a functional fascia.
Yeah, it has to be functional.
Wonderful. Any other principles that you would like to share with us?
Oh, spur of the moment, think of prayer. I can't think of anything else.
Okay. Well, I would like to ask you one of my favorite questions. Yeah, go ahead.
One more thing, the principle. You have to do everything on the right side, you have to do everything on the left side.
So, again, the balance.
Balance. All right. So, and you have to do things slow. How did I forget that principle? Hmm. Slow. If you move at speed, your compensation patterns are always there. Mm-hmm. You can't undo them if you move at speed. So the only way to fix a problem is attention, awareness, and slow. And then you can reprogram neural pathways. There's been new research that says that basketball players who shoot an invisible ball get a 32% increase in their proficiency.
Invisible ball.
An invisible ball.
Well, that must be like something out of the virtual reality kind of thing.
Well, this is something new that's come about, and how powerful the mind is. If you shoot an invisible ball in the basket, it's always going to go in because it's not there. You shoot a real ball in the basket, every time you see it doesn't go in, you know it didn't go in. The people who practice without the ball do better than the people who do it with the ball.
Oh, that's basically how I, back 30 years ago or so, learned how to do muscle up.
I'm not sure that is.
Well, you know, chin ups?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So if you grab the bar, and you do the chin up, and then you just keep on going up. That's called muscle up.
Oh, okay.
And for the life of me, I couldn't do it. And I was like, wait a moment, my friends can do it, why can't I? I was a very well developed young man, and people said, well, you're strong enough, you should be able to do it. So my friend, who could do it relatively easily, told me, you know, I learned it by just visualizing how to do it. By just imagining what would it be like to grab a hold of the bar, do the chin up, and just keep on going smoothly all the way up, and then do the same but with an imaginary bar. Again, literally perform the movement with the arms and go all the way up. If you can do that smoothly in your visualization and then with your arms doing the movement, then the next step would be actually to come to the bar, grab hold of it, and get on top of it. And I did. The first time I did it, I tried, I got on top of it. I was like, wow, that was really awesome.
The power of the mind is so incredible. Mm-hmm. I have a patient that I'm working with right now who had MS for 14 years. And that's how I get her to start moving, is I make her do something, or I'll move her hand for her and do something, but I don't make her look at it. I make sure that she doesn't see it, because I need her to imagine it's happening, or I do it for her until she can start to do it. The power of the brain is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. The lady that I'm talking about is a doctor. She's a medical doctor, had MS for 14 years. And I have her walking, I have her driving. A year and a half ago, they carried her into her office and carried her out. And now she's self-sufficient again.
Nice.
And we started with visualization. Visualization. Stand up straight. Well, how do you know where you're straight? If you have MS and you're all crooked and everything like that. Well, imagine that. Stand up and get straight and shut your eyes. And think about how it used to feel to be straight, and now think about that again. Remember what it felt like. Now slowly move her shoulder into the right place and get it to relax. And she's walking, she's driving, she walks with a walker, but she's completely self-sufficient now. So visualization is probably the most powerful tool that we have at our disposal, but most people don't know it or don't believe it. And the belief part of it is critical. And that's why I make people shut their eyes when they're having a problem doing something. Because if you can't see yourself doing it, then the brain doesn't. I mean, if you can see yourself not doing something, you can't convince your brain that you are doing it. So you have to shut your eyes and make believe you're doing it, and sooner or later it'll start to happen.
Interesting. Is this what you also did with your own movement when you were?
Yeah, that was me. You know, I used to put a little thing over my eyes and imagine that I was doing it. Imagine. So I know for a fact how powerful the brain is, because my doctor's prognosis for me was that at some point in life I'd be able to help getting in and out of bed with assistance, and I would be in a wheelchair with a mouthpiece. So the visualization is what I did so much of to get me out of that. The doctors, we're planning a reunion with my doctor in May 20th, I believe it is. My doctor hasn't seen me now in over 20 years. When he found out I was doing Tai Chi, the lady that's writing the book from Hawaii, she was in touch with the doctor, and we sent him a DVD, and he said, people who recover any degree from quadriplegic or paraplegic They are never normal. They just don't have that ability to move again smooth. It's always jerky, it's always staccato-y. And when he saw that, she asked him, she said, well, what do you attribute this to? He said, well, in a church setting, we would call this a miracle. Uh-huh. He said, in a hospital setting, it's just the power of his mind. There's no other explanation, because there, the explanation is that you're not supposed to be doing any of this.
Right, so essentially you are an embodiment of the willpower or the power of the mind over matter, so to speak. Not over body, but actually working with the body to help it recover and prosper again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. It's a really a fantastic message to share with our listeners, and I appreciate you taking the time
to share this
message with us.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, and hopefully we give people hope. That's what this is all about. That's what Qigong has been about for 5,000 years. Give people a roadmap on how to get healthy.
Absolutely. Well, let me remind our listeners and viewers that you have just enjoyed an interview with Joe Pinella of Tucson, Arizona, on the talk show The Secrets of Qigong Masters, brought to you by Academy of Qidao, the first and only school in the world offering professional education in Tai Chi and Qigong coaching. To find out about programs dedicated to Tai Chi and Qigong certification, please go to qigongcoaching.com. The show is also brought to you by Mastery Magazine, sponsoring the Summit of Qigong Masters, bringing to you some of the top experts in Qigong in North America. Please go to qigongmasters.com to enjoy video interviews with them. Namaste.
Namaste.